This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 68 was recorded on June 22, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Former hedge fund manager turned private investor Jesse Felder will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. Longtime listeners know that my criticism of stock market bears is that they often argue that the market is overvalued, something I certainly agree with, but they seldom make a cogent argument as to what the proximal trigger or catalyst will be to indicate that now is when the downside trend reversal should occur. Now, Jesse is a big fan of Macro Voices and listens himself, so he was aware of my view on this subject, and he came armed with a book of graphs and charts showing why he thinks the tide is about to turn and the bulls are about to get burned. But wait, there's more. After our feature interview, Alistair Williamson from StockboardAsset.com will be joining Patrick and I in our postgame segment to do an extended coverage of this week's big story, which of course is the massive sell-off in crude oil.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, we taped today's show a couple hours early again this week, so our commentary won't include anything that has happened in the markets after 2 p.m. on Thursday. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 had obviously earlier in the week a little bit of a spill all the way down to about the 24-28 level on the downside, but we've now since been bouncing with the market trading right now around 24-37 on the S&P. What's your thinking on the markets here?
Well, as I've said many times before, I think that this market is way overvalued on a fundamental basis. But things, you know, I thought the tech stocks were overvalued in 1998, and they got a lot more overvalued in 1999, and even more overvalued than that by the beginning of 2000, before the bubble eventually burst. So the fact that valuations are out of control isn't enough. And as Martin Armstrong argued, the market can stay irrational for a very long time. So, you know, I've made this criticism that a lot of bears don't really support this argument of overvalued market with any concrete reason for why now is the time that we should expect a change in trend. I'm really looking forward to getting Jesse Felder on the program because he sent us a great book of charts that show a whole bunch of technical signals that are telling him that maybe that change of direction really is upon us. As for me, I'm on the sidelines, as I have been for a long time. If I were to play the equity market at all from the long side, it would purely be a lottery ticket play on out-of-the-money calls just in case this insanity continues further, which is entirely possible. The short side appears more to my sense of valuation. But again, the trend is your friend. The trend has been up. Why is now the time that we should believe it's going to reverse to the downside? Ask me again after the interview with Jesse Felder. He certainly intends to make that argument very strongly.
All right, well, let's look at that U.S. dollar index. I mean, we've now gone several weeks of consolidation, more or less a couple of teases below the 97 level, but it looks like the dollar index is at least stabilizing here. What's your thinking on the dollar?
Well, as I said last week, the big question is, will that bounce that we saw beginning last week have legs? Will that be a trend reversal, or is it just a bounce that's going to roll over? And I think the jury's still out. You know, we're trading now on a 97 handle today. We certainly haven't moved back above any of the key technical levels that would tell me that a trend reversal is happening. So I do continue to have a long-term bullish view on the dollar index for fundamental reasons that we've talked about over and over again on past shows. I'm still glad to be sitting this one out because I don't know how much longer this weakness that we've been seeing is going to continue. And the situation in Europe with the euro rally, you know, a little news event here and there could throw things in one direction or the other and could push the dollar even still lower. So I think it will reverse in the long term, but I'm happy to sit in the sidelines at least for now.
Now, the big story, of course, Eric, is that we got a big breakdown in oil down below its April, May lows. We're now trading down below the 43 handle. What's your thinking here on oil?
Well, actually, we're trading today as we're speaking just before 2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. We're looking at 42.86. That is a price not seen since November of 2016. On an intraday basis, we actually very briefly, just before yesterday's close on Wednesday touched a level that has not been seen since August of last year. So as bearish as I have been on this program about crude oil, even I have been surprised because, frankly, my charts show that we should have just above 43 or so seen a bounce point. And, you know, I am bearish. I think that the bottom is not in yet. I think we've got further to go to the downside. But we're way overdue for a bounce here. So taking out that key support, on one hand, you could say, okay, if you take out the key support, that means you've broken the line. We're not going to get the bounce. On the other hand, you could say maybe that's a false breakdown and that bounce is really overdue. I'm kind of leaning that way. It looked this morning like maybe that bounce was in process. But as I look now at 2 p.m. at the chart, it looks like we are rolling over again. And this time of day is very important, especially as we come into the 2:30 p.m. pit close, which has not happened yet as we're taping this particular segment. So we'll see what happens. I definitely think that there's room for a bounce all the way back up to 47.5 before another rollover and a further move down. Is that going to happen, or are we going to see an acceleration to the downside from here? I really can't figure it out. This chart pattern is very hard for me to read. There's a guy, though, who has gotten a lot of crude oil calls right in the last few months. That's Alistair Williamson over at StockboardAsset.com. Now, when I do technical analysis, Patrick, I focus on, I guess I call it old school technical analysis, trend lines, moving averages, that kind of thing. A lot of technicians these days are getting into this market volume profiling, which I really don't have any experience with. Alistair uses that, and he's talking about something called a P-shaped distribution in crude oil, and he thinks that this move below 43 could be the beginning of a very rapid dive to much lower levels. Since he's gotten so many calls right, what I'd like to do is invite Alistair to join us after today's feature interview with Jesse Felder, and we'll get into some of his work, look at some of his charts, and look at how he uses a different style of technical analysis and what his charts are telling him, because frankly, I'm a little bit confused here. I do think we have further to go to the downside. I don't think it's over yet, but do we see a big bounce here up to 47, or does this just accelerate to the downside? I can't decide.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing from Alistair as well. Now, let's move on to gold, though. You know, gold has really just been acting like a cross currency to the U.S. dollar index. You know, we first now just popped above 1250, and now we're back down below, trading around this 1247 level here while we're taping the show. What's your thinking on gold here?
Yeah, you know, I was looking at gold last night, and I was thinking, wow, Wednesday evening, it was really starting to look like something was up. Gold and silver were both catching a bid. And now on Thursday afternoon, it looks like it's rolled right back over again. Where it moved from yesterday was touching its 200-day moving average. It just touched it briefly during mid-session on Wednesday. And I think that was the trigger for a bounce. Did it get all the way back to its 50-day moving average, which is up at about 1260? No, it didn't. It only made it up to about 1256, and it looks to be rolling over again. The big number that I see on my screen is 1241. That is the 200-day moving average as drawn on the nearest futures chart. You have to be careful not to look just at the single month chart because that's misleading. What you care about is the nearest futures chart. That 200-day moving average is at 1241 spot 20. As we're speaking today on Thursday, if we see a downside violation of that, I think the selling could accelerate, but we'll have to see what the market brings us.
All right, next I want to quickly take a look at that 10-year yield, which is now trading around that 2.15 yield. We numerous times throughout the week tested, approached that 2.14 level, and yet are just bouncing around here. What's your thinking on interest rates here?
Well, on my chart, 2 spot 12 is the important support level. We did test that last week, I think. We're almost there. When we break through that, I think the next stop is 2%, and I do think we're eventually headed sub 2%. Exactly when all that happens, I don't know. It seems like in a lot of ways, you know, if Jesse Felder's call is correct and we're going to see markets in general and the reflation trade and the equity market all rolling over, that starts to portend higher bond prices, lower bond yields. Maybe that will accelerate the move. If those calls are wrong and the Trump rally continues, we're looking at almost, all-time highs in the stock market, despite all of the other news that we're looking at. If that rally continues, then who knows what happens. But I think we're headed below 2% before this is over.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Now, before we move on to the featured interview, I wanted to personally thank all those people that have made donations to Macro Voices. The $100 and $200 donations keep pouring in. And just on behalf of Eric and myself, you know, we greatly appreciate all the donations in any amount. So thanks for all the support, everyone. Now, joining us as this week's featured interview guest is Jesse Felder, which is the author of The Felder Report, producer of his own financial podcast, and retired hedge fund manager turned private investor. Registered users should definitely check out the Research Roundup email before the interview and download the link to Jesse's chart book. If you have not yet registered, look for the instructions next to Jesse's picture on our homepage. Eric's interview with Jesse Felder is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Jesse Felder, author of The Felder Report. And Jesse sent us a fantastic book of graphs and charts. I strongly recommend that you download it. Our registered users at macrovoices.com can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, we told you earlier in the program how to get the download. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us. You know, we've heard from so many people that are, you know, smart people, really prominent people saying, okay, this is crazy. This market is overvalued. It's time for it to roll over. And it was actually this week, I saw one guy, very prominent guy, wrote that this is the most heinously overvalued market in all of history. Another guy wrote this is the most egregiously overvalued market. And I'm thinking, okay, heinously or egregiously? I'm not sure which is stronger, but both of these guys left out the actual content from their articles about why they think now is the turning point. And it's something I really appreciate about your work is you don't just talk about valuations being out of sight, which I think we can all agree on, but you see some very clear reasons and technical indicators that you think this thing's rolling over. So why don't you tell us why that is and reference your chart book that you sent us?
Thanks, Erica. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. I'm a huge fan of Macro Voices. I catch it as often as I can. And so it's an honor for me to be on the show. Thanks. You know, I'm guilty of that same thing. I've been writing about the market being overvalued for a few years now. And, you know, I am a value guy at heart, but, you know, so people will probably be surprised at the first several charts in this deck that I put together because they're mainly technicals. And one of the main technicals I use is the DeMarc sequential indicator. And this is basically just a signal of trend exhaustion. So it tries to identify turning points in trends. And one of the things I wrote about last week, so these charts are a couple days old, is that I'm seeing these trend exhaustion signals on a variety of indexes across a variety of time frames. So, you know, I basically am looking at SPY, QQQ, and IWM, the three, you know, main ETFs I look at. And I'm seeing, you know, exhaustion signals on daily, weekly, and monthly time frames. So when I get those timeframes lining up like that and exhaustion signals on multiple levels, multiple indexes, multiple timeframes, that to me tells me that this trend is at risk of coming to an end. And so, you know, another thing I really look at in this regard is a variety of breadth indicators. And that also helps me try and understand the strength of the trend. And, you know, when breadth is really strong, you know, that's a powerful sign of strong upward momentum. And that's what we've seen in the markets for a long period of time until the last few months. And I really believe this last push higher in the stock market over the last few months is the final blow-off phase because these exhaustion signals are triggering, but also because breadth is signaling that this final move up is really running out of momentum. It's been all over the media, people talking about how it's been just the fangs really driving the market higher over the last several weeks or if not months. We're seeing things like on-balance volume, you know, that's really fallen off. The number, you know, even with the S&P hitting a new high this week, it was only more than a third of the stocks in the index trade below their 200 day moving average. So it's a lot of stocks are really starting to fall off at this point. And then one of the most fascinating charts, I think this is 14 in the deck, is the ratio of the equal weight SPY to the market cap weighted. And when this ratio is rising, it means that, you know, all the stocks in the S&P 500 are really participating, pushing the index higher. When the ratio is falling, it means that there's fewer and fewer stocks pushing it higher. And the correlation between the S&P 500 and this ratio is usually very positive, but it's been very negative negative over the last 2 months. In fact, it's been the most negative we've seen since July, August of 2007, which was right around the top of the last bear market. And if you look at that chart, you'll see almost every time there's a negative correlation between these two to the degree we're seeing now, at least precedes a correction. Last time that we saw it in 2007 in July and then December of 07, we saw a big divergence in this indicator. To me, I'm seeing exhaustion plus breadth signals that are confirming that this trend is, the uptrend's very, very tired.
Now, in your emails that you sent us, you made several references to 9-13-9 patterns, and there's a lot of 9s and 13s in the first few slides here. For some of our listeners who might not be familiar with that particular technical methodology, what is a 9-13-9 pattern? What does the 9 mean? What does the 13 mean? And what are the risk levels that you have identified on several of these charts indicate? Because I see in some cases you're going above the risk level, which in normal technical analysis, you know, once you've gone above it, it kind of means it invalidates the signal. So what are we seeing in terms of these indicators here?
Yeah, so when I first started getting into technical analysis, I think it was, 2004 or 5, the MARC indicators are one of the first things I discovered that seemed important to understand. And I actually met Tom and really had an opportunity to pick his brain about how he uses these. And I still kind of pick his brain on how these things work. And really, he's got a variety of indicators. This is the one for me that I found is very valuable and works well with other technicals that I use. Basically, a 9 is either a buy setup or a sell setup. So it's essentially 9 days in a row where you have a strong trend. And so if you understand technical momentum, it's kind of, a 9 will be that kind of Elliott wave, third wave type of a move higher, which is strong momentum. Sometimes, the 9 days up is enough, or 9 weeks, depending on the time frame, 9 months, is enough to have a short-term, reversal. The 13 that comes after that is the actual buy or sell signal. And what I notice, with these is that that's usually kind of like an Elliott wave terminology. That will be the fifth wave move, which is kind of the end of the trend, which has a lot waning momentum as compared to the 9. So a 9 is essentially a buy or sell setup. A 13 is the actual signal. Now, the risk level on the chart is actually, once you get the signal, you can calculate the risk levels, essentially take the difference between the high and the low on the day of the actual sell signal, in the case of these charts, and just add that range to the top, to the high of the day you get the sell signal. And if you trade above that range, invalidates the signal. So, but one of the things Tom told me about how these are used is that some of the greatest traders, Tom has worked for pretty much whoever's had the biggest hedge fund on the planet for the past 20 years. So he's worked for Paul Tudor Jones, Steve Cohen. And he said, some of these guys, I think he mentioned Paul Tudor Jones in particular, in a strong trend, they'll wait until the risk level's actually broken to put on the trade. And you'll see in the QQQ, that daily chart, we got a 9 and then a 13, and then the risk level was broken, and then it immediately actually reversed. So the signal was invalidated, but if you were trading it kind of in a Paul Tudor Jones way, you might have waited until the risk level was broken to actually put that trade on, because it's been such a strong parabolic move higher.
Well, and of course, the violation of the risk level to the upside might mean that it's about to run away from you. And in each of these cases, what we see is that started to happen and then it promptly reversed, which means I think you got the call right on that one in each of these cases that I can see here. As we move on, there's another topic that I know you've written quite a bit about, and I haven't heard a lot in the press about lately, I'd like to come back to, and that's corporate buybacks. Back in the day, corporate executives used to be hired to actually run the business for the benefit of the shareholders. It seems like the Wall Street mentality has crept into corporate management to where, if they have suddenly this massive capital at their fingertips because of artificially low interest rates, courtesy of the Federal Reserve, you would think that they would issue a bunch of bonds and buy capital equipment and expand their businesses and hire more American workers and do all that. But that's not what gets them a bigger bonus. They get a bigger bonus by buying back shares in their own companies to take that artificial low interest rate and translate it into an artificially high stock price, boost their bonus. But Jesse, that seems like, this. What's the old quote? What could go wrong here? What could go wrong here? And where do you think, how does this end eventually? Because I'd say 3 or 4 years ago, people were writing about how crazy the corporate buyback boom was and how surely it had to end if the Fed started to taper. Well, the Fed's tapered and then some. And we still have this craze of corporate buybacks boosting share prices. Does this all break at some point? And what happens when it does?
Yeah, man, that's a great question, and you're absolutely right. What's the easiest way for a CEO to make his bonus is to lever up the balance sheet by borrowing money to buy back stock and push the stock price higher, and reduce the flow to shares outstanding so EPS goes up faster. But yeah, I think this entire bubble, and I think it's a stock market bubble, was started and really predicated on the price insensitive buying by the Federal Reserve. Quantitative easing is essentially, we're just going to buy bonds. We don't care the price. We're just going to buy this amount every single month. And that price insensitive buying was kind of, the lead sled dog that enabled price insensitive buying on the part of corporations to buy back stock. And also has encouraged price insensitive buying by individual investors embracing passive investing. So I really think, we've just seen an incredible amount of, I call it price insensitive buying. And I think really it was GMO, Jeremy Grantham's firm, coined the term a couple of years ago. But it's just a pattern of price insensitive buying that's spread into essentially every market participant. And so, paying attention to who's the lead sled dog is the Federal Reserve and the central banks around the world. They have, tapered. And now they're talking about reducing the size of the balance sheet. And that should be, a wake up call, I think, in regard to a lot of these strategies. Buybacks have already started to drop off. And I think that's just because, a lot of companies have levered up. You look at, a chart I didn't include is you look at corporate leverage. And it's one that Jeff Gundlach shared in a presentation recently is that, leverage is back to all-time highs. Corporate debt to GDP and leverage is off the chart. But, the next chart in the deck here just shows the massive amount that's flowed into ETFs so far this year. And to me, this looks like people are looking at margin debt these days, another chart I shared in the deck to look for a sign of just massive risk taking. And usually, at the last two stock market peaks, we've seen a huge surge in margin debt. Well, we haven't seen that this time. Margin debt to GDP is at an all-time record. So I don't think people really have the capability of levering up like they did it. But you look at the inflows into ETFs right now, and it's just massive. To me, this looks like a final surge into these products that it's a capitulation of everybody who's held off, not wanting to get invested for one reason or another. They're finally embracing passive investing in a huge way. So to start the year.
Now, if we go back to page 21 here in your deck where you show quarterly share repurchases, it does seem to be, turning back down in the last two or three quarters. And this chart, it looks like, is only through the end of 2016. Do you think that's the beginning of a secular reversal? And do you think that that could be driving maybe the top that you think we're seeing in equity markets? Or is this just a blip here?
I think this really goes with the credit cycle too, right? Because it's the availability of credit that has allowed for this buyback boom. And if you look at, for me, all the signs in the credit cycle show that it's turning. I mean, the consumer is the biggest part of the economy, and we see credit card, defaults rising, we see auto loan, troubles starting in auto loans, and, banks are starting to reduce credit availability. The only part of the credit market that's still, thriving right now is the investor-driven, part of it. You see, investor money flowing into leveraged loans and these things. And to me, that's just psychology. That's just investors not understanding that we are very late in the credit cycle. I think if that investor psychology shifts in credit, and with oil selling off recently, I really think we could see that psychological shift any time now. High yield usually, is pretty closely correlated with oil, at least has in the last couple of years. And so, if the credit cycle is turning, there's no doubt in my mind that the money that's flowing into, the markets from buybacks is going to, be dramatically, this trend will continue, meaning that buybacks will continue to fall.
Well, I guess that sort of begs a question then, which is if the equity market starts to turn down, as you've suggested, and particularly if we get towards recession, that tends to drive bond prices up and yields down, at least in the treasury curve. So if we were to see a return to secular low treasury rates, do you think that sparks another round of corporate buybacks? Or do you think at that point the corporate credit market is kind of dried up, regardless of what happens to treasuries?
You know, I think it's, I mean, if you just look at this chart and you see the massive amount of buybacks that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years, we really only saw like, you know, a couple quarters of this in 2007 before it reversed. I can include that. I'll send another chart that shows that, you know, corporate leverage. Corporations just do not have the ability to lever up any further to buy back stock. So, you know, it would take a massive, you know, especially if we were, you know, to see a slowdown, an economic slowdown, right? That hurts their earnings and EBITDA and all these things, you know, then that absolutely, you know, puts the nail in the coffin of this buyback binge. I think the only way we could see buybacks really resume is if we did get a big economic, you know, resurgence that would really help with earnings and allow companies to continue to lever up. But that's highly unlikely in my view.
Your last chart here shows VIX futures positioning, and I want to touch on that. As I shared with our listeners last week, I actually saw a tweet on Twitter where one of the Twitter guys went out to a restaurant, and the waitress at the restaurant is short the VIX through the ETF. Now, I talked to Raul Paul about the short the VIX trade, and he said it was just so overcrowded like a year ago because so many pensions were just piling in to this ridiculous idea that you can basically camp on the contango in the VIX term structure. It produces a very, very attractive carry. And you're basically writing, you know, disaster insurance with no reserves. What could go wrong here? And how far could this go was the question I asked Raul. Well, now it's gotten to the point where the waitress in the restaurant is short the VIX. How much farther can this go and what happens next in terms of volatility in the market?
Yeah, I mean, this trade is unbelievable. It's, you know, and for me, what is really the most maybe worrisome part of it is that, you know, these products have not been around very long. If you look at this chart, it's really since 2011, 2012 that these products have traded anywhere near the size that they're trading in today. You know, in the last bear market, they were nothing. They were insignificant. And, you know, to me, I think it's not only this massive short VIX trade, but there are ton of strategies that are essentially now volatility targeting strategies. So I'm going to adjust my equity exposure based on the level of the VIX in a variety of different ways. I mean, you know, maybe the most well-known one is risk parity, and we'll use, you know, volatility targeting to manage their equity exposure. But there's insurance companies and all kinds of other strategies that are just pure volatility targeting. And so what I worry about is that if you have this massive short VIX trade and you do get a jump up in the VIX, it's got to be some kind of unforeseeable event probably that would inspire, you know, the VIX to double from 10 to 20 overnight. And these guys realize they can't hold on to this short position if the VIX is going to go to 30, 40, 50, and they're short this much of it at 10. That can create a huge bid for the VIX. And, you know, on the other side of this trade are commercial hedgers who have been, you know, getting long VIX to enable these guys to get short VIX. And what do they go do? They're long VIX. They go buy S&P to hedge that exposure to long VIX. And so as these guys have been getting short VIX over a long period of time, the first thing to think about is it's created a bid in the S&P, a persistent bid in the S&P for a long period of time, just hedgers, you know, in these VIX futures going and buying S&P. Now, if this trade starts to unwind and these guys have to cover their shorts, commercial hedgers have to sell VIX and then sell their S&P hedges, and then you have the volatility targeters on top of this, including risk parity. But I've seen estimates that it's, you know, it could be $2 trillion invested gross in strategies of volatility targeting, and they're all trying to unwind at the same time. It could cause, you know, to me, it just smacks of, you know, portfolio insurance. And like you said, Eric, when it gets to the point where it's the waitress, you know, who's selling VIX and recommending, it's reminiscent of all of these famous disturbances, to avoid the word crash, disturbances in the markets that we've seen historically over the last 100 years. And to just add to your story, I had somebody who, you know, approached me on Twitter recently, telling me that his Uber driver was telling him to sell naked put options against the S&P, that you could never lose money in that trade. And so it's fascinating to see where risk appetites are today, because these trades have gone so far. It's astounding.
Well, you know, the thing that really fascinates me about this particular situation with this massive, massive buildup of short interest in the VIX is that I struggle, frankly, to understand it. If you take a normal futures trade, let's say everybody's on the same side of the boat, they're all long crude oil. What happens? Everybody is on one side of the boat, price starts to go down, they all bail out, they all sell at once. It's very clear the result is crude oil sells off and the price goes down. That's easy to see. But when you look at the VIX, as you said, there's commercial hedgers. So if all of the sudden the VIX doubles overnight, everybody gets stopped out, that causes a massive wave of VIX futures buying. So the VIX futures are at 35%, even though the underlying stock market is not at 35%. There is, in terms of actual realized volatility, there's a huge number of triggers that happen, as you just said. I don't know what they all are. I can't get my head around all of the different knock-on effects and consequential implications of VIX futures suddenly starting to trade above 30 and what arbitrages that opens up. If I can't get my head around it, that means a lot of other risk managers don't really know what risks they're taking when they put this short trade on. And it just scares the crap out of me, Jesse, as to what could happen when we all realize one day in the postmortem, oh, we never realized how much risk there actually was in this massive buildup of short volatility, which everybody takes as if it's nothing.
Yeah, and it's really reminiscent of, you know, portfolio insurance, which was blamed for the 87 crash. I don't understand all the dynamics either, but it's something to me that is, you know, obviously something we've never seen before. And one of the main things I worry about is, you know, in the news lately, it's come out that, you know, algorithms and computer-based trading is now driving 60% of the volume in the stock market, you know, these days, and actual active investors are only responsible for 10% or less of the volume in the stock market these days. And I think the main just kind of, you know, big picture thing I worry about in terms of the algorithms and things is all of them are based on the last 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, maybe 50 years of trading. And they say, well, this VIX trade can't go wrong because this has never happened in 50 years of history. Well, the VIX is only, you know, 25 years old or something. And so we don't have that much data on it in history. But I guess the argument behind it is, you know, this has never been a problem in the past. The VIX has never gone, you know, up fast enough to cause it to be a problem in the past. And it just reminds me of, you know, the housing bubble. You know, they said housing prices have never gone down on a nationwide basis year over year. That's never happened before. And, you know, I think it was Jeff Gundlach said recently, as soon as you hear people use the term never, it's about to happen, you know. And so for me, you know, we hear people talking about, you know, that could never happen to the VIX. Well, that's, you know, for me, red flag going up.
Well, the other thing, too, in addition to what you mentioned, is that the traditional providers of liquidity in the market don't exist anymore. We don't really have market makers because high-frequency traders have run them out of business. And even in the 2008-2009 crisis, we had those traditional liquidity providers in the market. So what happens if it takes all of 31 milliseconds for all of these high-frequency trading algorithms to say, hey, something's wrong, pull out, and suddenly there's no buyer of last resort or provider of last liquidity? And it makes me wonder, you know, we've talked through a few scenarios here. You mentioned the 87 crash and what happened there. We've talked about the VIX and the structural, you know, nobody's sure what could go wrong. On the other hand, some of the other things that you mentioned around buybacks, say, I mean, that's kind of a trend that's going to taper off and eventually reverse. So when you talk about maybe we're at or very close to a top here, does that mean to you that a crash is imminent, or does it just mean that maybe a trend reversal is going to slowly begin and we're going to drift lower from here in terms of where markets hit?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, it's my belief that a crash is as high a probability today as it's ever been. You know, now a crash is not a high probability event, and I don't even know how to start to go put a probability on it. But looking at the underlying dynamics, and, you know, just thinking about it's been price insensitive buying that has driven prices higher over the last, you know, 7-8 years. In every market cycle, we've seen that type of buying turn into selling. And so, you know, there's liquidity on the way up. When all these price insensitive actors in the markets are buying, you know, there's liquidity on the way up. But if all of these, you know, let's say passive investors decide to become sellers, and this is just human nature, it's how it works, then you make a good point. Who's there to buy? There are no market makers. There are no more. I mean, how many value investors are there left in the market to say, okay, you know what, stocks are cheap now, I'm going to step in and start buying? You know, all the money has flown out of active. So I wonder, you know, who is it going to, you know, step in to buy in an event where, you know, we start to see price insensitive selling. And, you know, and then that maybe begs the question of, you know, maybe the gang who started it all in terms of price insensitive buying steps in and starts to try and support the stock market. But that's, you know, we're getting a few steps ahead, you know, for the Fed to try and, you know, buy equities would we'd have to see a, you know, crash type experience, I think.
Well, I think the other important point that, that what you just said kind of brought to my mind is active is not where it's at. Most of what's going on in investing now is passive index investing. So what you have to worry about is when the long-term buy and hold, not going to touch it, not changing anything, people, when the owners of those assets panic and lose faith in the institutions that they've placed their trust in. Well, look at what's going on around us in politics in terms of riots in the streets. You know, people who either love Donald Trump or hate Donald Trump are literally at each other's throats, beating each other with baseball bats, because our societal mood has become so reactive and so violent. So it just makes me think, boy, if there is a small panic where people start to say they don't trust financial institutions at all, just give me all of my money, I want it in cash, I'm taking it out, I don't care about staying invested for the long haul. If that gets started, boy, it could run away quickly, and I don't know what would happen at that point.
Well, yeah, and that's a good point. That could be a catalyst. You know what, a catalyst I think about, too, is just from a demographic standpoint, the only people who really own equities these days are, you know, baby boomers. And so I think a lot of this push to passive investing is just a function of, you know, baby boomers getting, you know, more aggressive with their allocations and thinking that, you know, if I'm passive, then I can put 60, 70, 80% of my money into the equity markets instead of, you know, doing something more traditional would be, you know, 100 minus my age is, you know, should be my, you know, allocation to equities. And, you know, and that would be for a lot of these, you know, baby boomers, you know, 30, 40% allocation of stocks. You know, I've seen anecdotal stuff. The Wall Street Journal ran an article recently and showed a, you know, a dentist who's, you know, I think in his 60s or something and maybe close to 70 and has retired dentist who has, you know, 80% of his money in the equity markets right now. If baby boomer, you know, market starts to sell off and baby boomers realize they're way too exposed to the equity markets, that might be all it takes is say, you know, hey, 60, 70, 80% is too much exposure for a retiree. And, you know, that could turn price insensitive buying into price insensitive selling.
Another topic that you've written about is a secular shift away from financial assets in favor of real assets, things like land and gold and so forth. You know, I really just couldn't agree with you more in principle that that has to happen, because you look at the financialization of the economy over the last 30 years or so, and we've gotten to these just crazy high valuations for what's really just paper. Someday it all has to fall apart. But frankly, Jesse, you know, I started reading Dr. Chris Martinson writing about that subject a good 10 or 12 years ago, and it hasn't really happened yet in terms of a major trend. So when do you, or what are the catalysts and triggers that eventually cause an exodus from financial assets into hard assets?
That's a great question. And basically, you know, I ran across a chart a year or so ago, and I'll include this in the chart deck also, is basically the ratio of financial assets to real assets. You look over long periods of time, during the high inflation of late 70s, you know, early 80s, you see real assets very highly valued. You know, that was the best time to be a buyer of equities that we've seen in our lifetimes is, you know, 80, 82. We're essentially the opposite today, where financial assets have never been more highly valued in history. And if you look at my chart on page 20 of the deck here, it shows corporate enterprise value to sales. And essentially, this is equity and debt, corporate equity and debt relative to their sales. This has never been, this ratio has never been higher in history. And so to me, that shows it's not just stocks that are overvalued, it's stocks and bonds. And, you know, if you look at the ratio of financial assets to real assets have never been cheaper in history. So if you're a value guy like me, you go, okay, real assets, that's interesting. Maybe that's a long-term trend that's going to be interesting over the next 10 years. I think what changes it is probably a longer-term, a secular, I think the most obvious thing would be a shift in inflation. I think as long as we see inflation remain tame, you know, financial assets are going to be preferred over real assets. But if inflation starts to pick its head up again, I think investors will be encouraged to look at real assets. And what might catalyze something like that is I look at almost everything Donald Trump wants to do. And this is not a political comment. This is just, you know, from the standpoint of looking at it from an economic standpoint, is inflationary. You know, he wants to be he wants to be more trade protectionist. That's going to raise prices. He wants to build, rebuild the infrastructure. Well, we have 4% unemployment. Where are you going to find people to build a wall, you know, on the border? You're going to have to, you know, pay a ton of money to find those people. And there's a lot of things that he wants to do that are inflationary. And right now it doesn't look like he's going to be able to get his agenda across. But I think in the next recession, one trend we might see around the world is the monetary authorities essentially handing off the baton to the fiscal authorities to say, hey guys, we're at 0% interest rates. We have been forever. This isn't working. It's not helping the economy. You guys need to start pulling your share of the weight and seeing fiscal authorities really start to get involved. And that's where inflation will, I believe, where inflation will start to take off again.
You know, I'd love to get your feedback on a view that I've held for several years, which is people ask me, where is all this headed? And I say, you know, I have no idea how long it takes. But the end game starts when you get to runaway inflation. And the reason I say that is, you know, no matter what goes wrong, if central banks can print money out of thin air and get away with it and use it to solve problems and just throw money at whatever is bothering them, that works. It has to at least kick the can down the road. When you get to a runaway inflation backdrop where central bankers' hands are tied, they cannot conjure more money out of thin air because that would just exacerbate the runaway inflation and push us into a true hyperinflation. That's, to me, where the end game starts, is when their hands are tied by runaway inflation. Would you agree with that view? And do you have any opinion at all on how far away we might be from a situation where the options available to policymakers are limited by inflation?
Yeah, you know, I think it's this dynamic between the fiscal and monetary authorities. Monetary authorities can do almost whatever they want as long as the fiscal authorities are staying so conservative as they are. And it might sound silly, but, you know, Europe has experimented with austerity. And so, you know, the central bank, European Central Bank, can almost do whatever they want, and it's not going to be inflationary because the fiscal authorities are being so conservative. But as soon as the fiscal authorities change that policy, change that view and say, we have to do something, we have to put people to work, we have to do these things, then that essentially, you know, puts the central banks into a bind. If inflation starts picking up because fiscal authorities start becoming really aggressive, you know, that does put them in a bind. Are they going to enable it, right, by buying the, you know, bonds directly from, you know, these sovereign entities? Or are they going to have to turn their attention to fighting inflation? And I think that's when it gets really interesting. But to me, the main thing I'm watching is watch the fiscal authorities, see what their plans are, because in the next economic slowdown, I think they're going to really, you know, the central banks are going to say, hey, look, guys, it's your turn. And if the fiscal authorities really start to get aggressive, it will potentially kick off that process you're talking about.
We've talked about a secular transition eventually from financial assets into real assets. You've talked about being a value guy. So I'm sure the gold bugs in the audience want to know where you stand on gold, because, of course, one argument is gold is the ultimate real asset. And, you know, some people would say it's cheap here. You ought to just back the leverage truck up and, you know, buy as many gold futures as you possibly can, or physical gold if you're in that camp, and put all your money there. Is gold actually cheap here? Or do you think that the deflationary wind in the air and the general turnover, you know, look at the CRB index rolling over. If you believe that gold trades with other commodities, commodities aren't looking real good right now, although a lot of people don't hold that view. What do you see for gold and precious metals in general looking forward?
I'm bullish on gold. I think it's in this era of unprecedented experimental monetary policy. It's, you know, as Stan Druckenmiller said a year ago, it's the only currency that I really want to own, you know, longer term. Shorter term, there's a lot of different, you know, dynamics going on, and, you know, watching the dollar yen and whatnot. But I think longer term, I really do like gold. And I think it goes a lot higher. Now, for me as a value guy, from an investment standpoint, I focus mainly on some gold mining stocks over the last couple of years. Some of the gold miners at the end of, you know, 2015, you could buy them as a traditional Graham net Ben Graham net stock, essentially buy them at, you know, a 50% discount to their liquidation value. And there's some that still trade significantly below book value, which is, you know, for me, a very attractive way to play gold because it builds in a margin of safety for me. But yeah, I'm definitely bullish gold. And I think right now it's battling that downtrend line. And it looked like it broke out recently, but then it gave it right back. In terms of DeMarc signals, we just did get a 9, you know, buy setup yesterday on the daily chart. So it could be, you know, close to another near-term bottom. But I think we need a catalyst for gold to get it up above that 6-year downtrend line that it's been doing battle with over the past year and a half.
I'd like to change gears now, Jesse, and talk about your own experience with finance. You've described yourself as just a totally committed finance geek. You obviously love this stuff. You love writing about this. You've made time for our listeners by giving us this wonderful interview today. You ran a hedge fund. Almost any sane person would think, gee, if you're doing all of this work of spending all your time and energy on the markets, surely you would continue to run a fund and be compensated by having other people invest alongside you. You got to the point where you preferred to just walk away from running other people's money and just focus on running your own money and family money, but you still seem to have the energy to, you know, do interviews like this and publish a fantastic newsletter. What's going on with you that soured you on the professional money management business, and why do you prefer just to run your own money at this point?
You know, it's a great question. Really, what's most rewarding for me is has been educating people. I think this is they say, may you live in interesting times. We live in some fascinating times. And for me, it's been very valuable to just share my thoughts with people who are looking for a different answer, something that they don't hear on, you know, CNBC or, you know, through. I really think right now this passive propaganda is so strong, and there are people out there that want to hear something different. And so for me, it's been trying to just educate people. You know, I think with running money and raising money and these types of things, there's so much more that goes into it besides just doing the research and the investment side of it. For a lot of people ask me about, you know, starting businesses and these types of things. And one of my favorite books in that regard is The E-Myth, The Entrepreneur Myth. And just because you like baking doesn't mean you should open a bakery. And so, I'm not a fan of the business side of Wall Street. And so that's why I focus on the parts of it that I love, which is the research and investing and then just sharing my ideas.
Well, and you've been incredibly generous doing that. The Felder Report is a great newsletter. I believe you've also just launched a podcast of your own. So please tell us, tell our listeners where they can find out more about your work, The Felder Report, what's in the podcast, and what's available.
Yeah, thefelderreport.com is a blog that I've been writing since 2005. And yeah, I just recently started a podcast. I was inspired by Macro Voices, among, you know, a couple others, to really do it myself. And, you know, there's just a number of people that I talk to that I consider super investors, people who have really inspired my process over the years. And I said, shoot, why don't I, you know, just record some of these conversations I'm having with these guys and put it up as a podcast. And so I interviewed Eric Cinnamon, small cap manager who, you know, doubled the return of the Russell 2000 over the past, you know, 20 years or something. I interviewed Bill Fleckenstein, who's, you know, a friend of mine, and we had a just fascinating conversation. And the newest one coming out is I finally got to interview my friend Todd Harrison, who ran Minionville and Kramer Berkowitz hedge fund, and we talked about his new venture in, you know, cannabis wellness space. So there's so much fascinating stuff going on out there, and I think I'm in a privileged position to be able to talk to some of these guys and share their wisdom with my audience. So yeah, that's what it's about.
So thefelderreport.com is the place to look for the blog. I assume the podcasts are at the same URL?
Yeah, felderreport.com/podcast.
Fantastic. Final question, because all of our listeners, I know, have been wondering this. Dude, what is with the picture on Twitter? Is that you? Are you at the top of Mount Everest? What's going on there?
No, that's the beard. So I think it was late 2014, actually September 2014. Market had gone straight up through 13 and 14, and I said, I tweeted. I said, I'm not shaving until we get a 10% correction, because we hadn't had a 10% correction in like 5 years or something. Maybe not that long, 3.5, something. And the market promptly went down 9.8% in September of 2014. And, you know, people were telling me, just round it up to 10 and shave. I said, no, it's not 10. It doesn't count. And so, I didn't shave for 11 months until the August 2015 sell-off, when finally we had our first 10% correction in 4 or 5 years or something. And so that's finally when I went and shaved the beard off. But yeah, the beard got pretty epic there for about 11 months.
Well, that finally we have unearthed a story that I know many people on Twitter have been wondering about for years. So I can't thank you enough, Jesse, for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
You know, Eric, what a great interview with Jesse. But before I comment on that, I just wanted to welcome Alistair Williamson to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm here down in Baltimore, Maryland. I've been listening to the show for quite some time, and it's great information that you have here.
Thanks. Well, Eric, you know, I was listening to that interview with Jesse, and, you know, when we look at our pregame show and you were commenting on the markets, we really do have two schools of thought. Those people that will stand by the fact that the market is incredibly expensive, it's overvalued. And then we have the other school of that basically says valuations don't matter. There's huge momentum in the market, and there's everything that's going to drive this market to like this parabolic melt-up phase. It's nice to bring Jesse on here with some technical perspectives, and he brought that chart book on there. And one of the key observations, obviously, that he made is that there's trend exhaustion, that these moves are very long in the tooth, and that this could all roll over. And I thought that was really insightful. You know, it kind of goes with that Jeffrey Gundlach kind of perspective that potentially a correction this summer may be afoot. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that both of those views are correct. The market is ridiculously overvalued, but we also know that the way bull markets end is when ridiculously overvalued things get even more ridiculously overvalued in a parabolic blow-off top. So I think we're definitely in the late stages of things. The question is, let's suppose, and I think it's likely true, that the signals that Jesse is seeing are telling us that the trend's about to change. Does that mean that we're just going to have a little 5% correction? Buy the dip and go into the fall and into the winter with even more crazy upside? Or does it mean that we really are seeing a secular trend reversal? I don't know how to tell that. When I see these trend exhaustion signs, they don't say to me that the craziness is over. They just say that we're overdue for a correction. So I don't really know what's coming next. I do think that both of those views are right. These valuations are insane. They don't make sense, but they never make sense in the late stages of bull markets.
Well, Eric, in the market wrap, I want to go to oil here. You were saying that we wanted to elaborate a little bit more on what's going on in the oil markets. What's on your mind?
Well, as our listeners know, I've been very bearish on oil in the last several shows. But frankly, you know, the style of technical analysis, I'm mostly a fundamentals guy. I use technical analysis to time my entries and exits to trades, and I don't claim to be expert at it. And I use things like trend lines and price channels and moving averages. We've seen a death cross. We have seen the breakdown very decisively below the 200-day moving average. But if I look at the price channel, it looked to me at just above 43. We should have seen a bounce that might have taken us all the way back to 47 and change. What we saw was actually an accelerated sell-off. All of a sudden, the bottom fell out of the market on Wednesday morning. And, you know, it really struck me that I had been following Alistair's work and what he's been saying for weeks now about a P-shaped distribution in the market volume profile really resonated for me. I'm like, hey, what I'm looking at on this chart that is just collapsing before my eyes is exactly what Alistair was saying, which is once you get below 43, all hell can break loose because there's no support. I don't want to try to summarize Alistair's work because, frankly, I don't understand all of it. So, Alistair, thanks so much for coming in. You've sent us a few charts. Please reference those. And listeners, you can find the link to Alistair's charts in your Research Roundup email. For those of you who haven't registered yet, you can find the instructions next to Jesse's picture on our homepage for how to register and get the download. Tell us, for maybe some of our listeners that, like myself, know what technical analysis is but don't know about volume profiles, what are you talking about when you say a P-shaped distribution in crude oil?
Eric, thank you for having me on here. And in this presentation I'm going to give, please pay attention to 1 through 5 charts in the chart book. So what we use is, and imagine on a chart, you have an X-axis volume, you have your average volume line. We're going to flip that to the Y-axis, and we call that volume profile, or we could even call that market profile. Basically, it's a charting tool to observe the two-way auction, or commonly called the dual market auction, i.e. it's the buyers and sellers going back and forth. It's the ebb and flows of price over time in a way that reveals patterns in the herd. How markets trend, or excuse me, how markets play on the playing field, is they go from a balance to an imbalance to a balance, and that repetition is seen over and over again. So what we have with the, especially with crude, is we started noticing on the Y-axis, using the volume profile, P-shaped distribution. Now, a P-shaped distribution typically occurs as a result of a short cover rally. And that is exactly what we have seen in oil. And if we flip to chart one, we notice, and you can look on the chart, the P-shaped distribution is on the Y-axis. Notice the short tail from about a single print TPO. That's a time-priced opportunity. What a time-priced opportunity, basically, it's the basic auction building blocks recorded by the profile, and we call that sometimes a TPO. And the three components of a TPO is price, which advertises opportunity. There's a clear distinction between price and value. And then T, which is time, it regulates all advertised opportunities. And then we have the volume, which is measures the success or failure of these advertised opportunities. So each node on the Y-axis, it represents a market that is either trending or not trending. And we can take the structure or the framework of that Y-axis and understand the underlying auction. That is exactly what we did here in oil. So chart one, what we understand in 1Q 2016, it was a massive short cover. It was narratives. There was engineered events that we saw, supply disruptions around the world, strikes. We saw Canadian wildfires. I mean, we even saw the Nigerian Delta Avengers. These sequential engineered events, along with OPEC's narrative, was able to take oil from an unfair level, which is that single print TPO at 26 or thereabout, I think it was 26.10, something on those lines, up to 55. Now, the way that the market was able to distribute was that, and usually this P-shaped distribution happens in a downtrend, which you can see it, but the short cover liquidation pushed up the market real quick, and then we saw the longs get in. Now, this was all due in part to these engineered events, these narratives. So what we see is a large body, the top part of the P. You can literally see the P, and we saw rotations, and we'll call those rotations from 43 to about 55. Now, what happened is that in the next leg up, if that cannot produce, you will be sitting with so much overhead that if not handled properly, we would see a very big liquidation. Now, what happened, I think it was yesterday or a couple of days ago, we probed into the 40, underneath the 43 handle, which there is no support. Let's put that in our minds here. If you look at the P-shaped distribution, notice how those nodes on the Y-axis, there aren't any. That's the danger here. And every time we've been to this level before, it's been an engineered event. There's been something with OPEC coming out as far as a narrative, maybe rebalancing, maybe cuts, or an engineered event of some type of supply disruption around the world. But we didn't see that right now, which is very interesting. So we probed into these low volume nodes, I think it was yesterday, and when we touched into the 43, then 42, the price moves quick. Now, what happens is that if there isn't an engineered event, there isn't any type of supply disruption out there, And we're going to switch to the next charts here on the slides. We will go down so quick, so fast that the mainstream media will tell us, oh, well, we didn't see this coming. This is my take on it. It is the fault of OPEC. It's the fault of the hedge funds behind OPEC. This is the fault of governments and central banks in the way they distribute oil. This is their fault. And for the reason of that, we're going to have to deal with the consequences of taking oil from 26 to 55 and not rebalancing the market. I mean, we were going heavy here in Baltimore, long at 27. And we were believing that the narrative, we were believing that the rebalancing was going to happen in the second half of 16. We get to the second half of 16. Well, oh, you know, it's the first quarter of 17. Well, we were just in the first quarter of 17. It's going to happen in the second half of 17. We get to where we are today, and it's not even going to happen to maybe first quarter of 18. So it's being pushed further and further out, and we're probing into low volume nodes. We don't have an engineered event. So I'm going to give you the scenarios on chart two in your chart book.
Okay, so let me stop you for a second, Alistair, and make sure I understand. When we talk about this P-shaped distribution, we're looking at the volume, and there's been so much volume of trading between about 43 or 44 up to 54 or so. And if I understand the theory of this correctly, if there's been a lot of trading there in the past, then there's a lot of indecision at those price levels, and that's what kind of holds thing at those price levels. Once you move down to a price level where historically there was very little volume in the other direction, the prediction of this style of analysis is basically if those price levels were causing the price to move quickly last time, they're going to move quickly this time in the opposite direction. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, so once an auction probes into low-volume nodes, the ease of move in price is much quicker. And some of those reasons is because there really hasn't been any exploration or probing of this area. There's not shares or contracts or anything else sitting heavy in these areas. So there's limited sentiment, and what we can do is we can slice through in low volume nodes below that 43, 44 level, Eric, like you just mentioned. We can slice through levels much quicker and much faster, which would mean that OPEC or some larger entity will have to do some type of drastic measure here, or this is all going to unwind in a very big way. And if we switch to chart two, we give various scenarios. And some of these scenarios I'm giving on chart two here is scenario one. And what we have laid out here is a double distribution. So basically, we're going to see perhaps in this scenario a double bottom and test the levels that we saw in 1Q of 16. What ultimately has to happen here is we have to flip from a P-shaped distribution to a B-shaped distribution. Now, a B-shaped distribution looks exactly like a B. What our intention here overall is to create an overall bell-shaped curve. And what we're going to do, and you can look in scenario one, we essentially tag the bottoms of 1Q of 16, then we bounce back up to the highs of that 43, 44 level, and then we come back again. So these are rotations that we're seeing, and what's going to happen is that we're going to see a lot of volatility very soon in this scenario, and then we're going to kind of have that volatility decline. Meanwhile, we're filling out this, and you can see the gaps there. We're going to fill out this double distribution and form it as one. Okay, so what we have on scene two is we have about a 36 level we want to hit and then bounce right back up to the 43, 44 level and then ultimately form that balance much higher than the first scenario. Going to scene three, we would need an engineered event. And this engineered event is basically take us where we are today, where we see these various V-shaped formations in that 40 to 42, 43 level, and we would come back up and probe into the mid part of the 44 up to 48, and then just have basically volatility die off there, and then determine what the next market generated information is. To end on this chart book on slide five, what we have is about a 30-year perspective, and this is where it gets serious, because this P-shaped distribution, you can see it on a much larger time frame and understand that this area, so 42, 43 up to about the 50, 55 range, has been symbolic for a support, has been symbolic for a V-shaped recovery. And we saw that in the 07-08 time period. This time around, we broke below that P-shaped distribution and probed a lower low than we saw in 07 and 08. And now we're actually failing to create a V-shaped recovery in oil, which can allude to us this lower for longer, this rebalancing. I've heard reports that this rebalancing could take as far as 2020, not 18. And what we would do here is we would fill in, like we gave in those scenarios, you know, this lower for longer, and fill in these balance areas from that low we saw in 1Q of 16. And we would stay in a bracketed level for quite some time, 26 to 44. You know, is that the new normal? That's the purpose of what I'm trying to convey here, is the new normal, 26 to 44, not 50 to 80, which is what we had all these ridiculous, actually, is like maybe 50 to 65 to 70, that all these ridiculous analysts coming out earlier this year and last year, you know, calling for this V-shape. I mean, is that dead? Is that talk dead? And that's what I'm here to say. If we get knocked off of this P-shaped distribution, that talk is dead and lower for longer for many years to come to rebalance this market. And the reason for that, it's because of the P-shaped distribution. It's because how the overseers of oil chose to initially create that V-shaped dip, which didn't lead to rebalance. It left to even more oil stockpiled in crude products and crude. And it's a demand issue too. I mean, we can even go back to the U.S. economy and understand, you know, what's happening. We have a demand issue in crude products this year.
Now, Alistair, I just wanted to ask you a question here. Like, your charts are showing here all of these volume nodes and so on these monthly charts. But now we've had some very aggressive selling in oil over the last, let's say, month, or even actually all from the start of the year. Now, you know, when I look at technicals, I tend to use things like Fibonacci's and asymmetry moves and all sorts of different things. And I look at oil and I see that oil, for instance, from the January highs all the way to its March lows, there was about a $10 decline from 58 to 48. We had an April decline from the $55 level down to about the $45 level in May. And then again, in late May all the way to currently, we had a move from about $52 down to about $42. Each one of those drops in oil were about $10 in length. So there's some symmetrical declines that are occurring. Now, even though we've broken this 43 node and we basically have seen this plunge, to me, oil is very short-term oversold. Like from my technicals, I would envision oil getting a bounce from this kind of 42, 43 level, even retrace back to 45, 46. In the way that you approach the markets, do you see something like that?
We need an engineered event. That's as simple as I can tell you. Every time crude falls to a technical level or breaks a technical support, it's usually an engineered event that you see from OPEC. And, you know, these technical events have a market-generated information to move them as far as a V-shaped dip. We would need something as far as a supply disruption around the world. Otherwise, I've said this before, we're going to have a very big unwind. Overhead supply is unlocking from this top part of the distribution, or P-shaped distribution, from 55. I mean, understand, we've slid from that 50 to 55 bracket. We've slid to the 42s in a matter of 4 months, maybe 3.5 months. And that is a very, very telling picture that overhead, in a very big way, overhead supply is unlocking. So probing into these low volume nodes, it's bad news. Right now, it is bad news. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you what these market generated information acts will be. But what I can tell you is a high probability. So we want to be very careful of the 42 to 43 level, you know, create signals and understand on your trading platform that this is a level to watch. And if support cannot be held here, we're going down to 35 very, very quick.
And of course, Alistair, when you say an engineered event, you're talking about OPEC manufacturing what some of us call fake news to cause the market to move. And, you know, the way I've been looking at this, OPEC has had a goal of doing two things. One is to keep the price above 50 bucks all the way through their IPO that they intend next year, and also to try to engineer backwardation into the curve in order to injure the ability of U.S. shale producers to finance their projects. They failed at both of those goals, and human nature tells us that when somebody fails at something, they do one of two things. They try much harder, or they give up and stop trying. And I think that really is the question here. Is OPEC going to try much harder and double the size of their production cuts and you know, tell a whole new narrative that causes the engineered event that you're talking about? Or are they going to recognize that their ability to influence the market is falling apart and just go back to competing for market share? I'd love to go another 45 minutes with you on this subject because I know it's one that's passionate for both of us. But unfortunately, in the interest of time, we're going to have to leave it there. Before we go, Alistair, for people who are interested in more of your views, not only on oil, but also you do a lot of work on, you know, treasury yields and the reflation trade, equities, everything else. Please tell our listeners where they can follow your work.
Thank you, Eric, for having me on here. You can find my work at Stockboard Asset on Twitter. You can also take a look at our website, stockboardassets.com. A very interesting point, and it's quite interesting. We do cover a lot of the reflation trade, and we're looking at the twos and tens curve and understanding that the downward slope this year is very concerning, and the bond market is very uncertain about, I would assume, the economy going forward. And we see oil correlating with that downward slope of the twos and tens, the flattening of the yield curve. And we're looking at the dollar selling as well along with that. And then you throw up the U.S. oil onto it, and it's all declining in sync. There are some major issues in the U.S. economy right now. And I think oil, the yield curves, and the dollar are signaling that. Meanwhile, a decoupled in the S&P shows us, you know, where the central banks have focused most of their time, which is the S&P.
Unfortunately, we do have to leave it there. Listeners, please let us know how you like this new format of bringing a second guest into the program after our feature interview. And of course, we do need your help promoting the program, so please forward your research roundup emails, tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best feature interview guests. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email, which never contains advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all the cool free stuff that we could find on the internet each week, including things like both Jesse and Alistair's chart books that went along with today's interviews. Patrick, tell them what they can expect in this week's research roundup.
Well, first off, you'll find the transcript for today's interview with Jesse. As well, like you were suggesting, there's the links to the chart books discussed during the interviews, both with Jesse and Alistair, available right there in the Research Roundup. There's a Bloomberg article also discussing the $2 trillion project to get Saudi Arabia's economy off oil. There's also a link to an article discussing Citi's Matt King's analysis of the global credit impulse and the impact of central banks trying to exit. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.